From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After serving as President Bush's press secretary, never going off message, Scott McClellan is delivering a message the administration does not want to hear. In his new memoir and in press interviews, he's criticizing the administration for misleading the American people on the reasons we went to war in Iraq, and for advocating policies that were driven by the desire to win and keep the support of the religious right. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with McClellan, play back a couple of his more contentious press briefings, and ask, among other things, if he read the early tell-all books by disillusioned members of the Bush administration, like Paul O'Neill and Richard Clark. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by country music singer Ashton Shepherd. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan has been spending a lot of time facing the press in the past few days, but now he's not speaking on behalf of the Bush administration. In fact, he's been criticizing it, as he does in his new memoir, What Happened, Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. McClellan describes himself as someone who had been a Texas loyalist, a trusted member of the president's senior-most team of advisors. He first worked for Bush in 1999 as his gubernatorial spokesman. He was a traveling press secretary for the Bush-Cheney 2000 campaign, and during President Bush's first term was chief deputy to Press Secretary Ari Fleischer. He served as President Bush's press secretary from July 2003 through May 2006. Scott McClellan, welcome to Fresh Air. Some of the things that have been said about you, this isn't the Scott McClellan we knew. We're puzzled. You're disgruntled. I've heard your qualifications for the job of press secretary questioned, as well as your intelligence. Bob Dole described you as a miserable creature. Your motives for writing the book have been described as, well, he did it for the money. Is this the campaign against you you were expecting? You had to expect that there was going to be a campaign against you when you wrote the book.
I did expect it to an extent. I think I'm a little surprised about how personal some of the tone of it is. But look, I knew this book would strike a nerve, and it needs to, because the larger message in the book is about how do we move beyond this destructive partisanship that has existed in Washington for, you know, at least the last 15 years. It was something we pledged to change, and instead we got caught up in it. I got caught up in it. You know, it's interesting that there are all these comments, and it's trying to turn the book into these gotcha points, and it's really missing that larger message of moving beyond the permanent campaign culture and restoring some honesty and bipartisanship and civility to the whole process in D.C. No one's really refuting the key themes and perspectives in the book, so they're doing what they are used to doing, which is misrepresenting what it says and personally attacking me. That's Washington. But I think it's very important. And if talking about unpleasant truths is what is needed to force change, then all the better.
Now, one of the things you write about in the book is how the White House would enlist the help of conservative talk show hosts and other, quote, friends in the media, conservative columnists, talk radio personalities. And they'd be given communications packets with comprehensive talking points. How does that work?
That's right. No, I mean, you pretty much just summed it up. We had a massive operation in the White House, massive political operation. It was not new. It certainly existed before us. I think to some extent we took it to new lengths. And Karl Rove, of course, being the senior advisor. But everything was well coordinated amongst some of the political operation in the Office of Strategic Initiatives, for example, as well as the White House communications operation. And when we need to get information out, we've got a whole long list of conservative allies and friends, whether it's talk radio, whether it's columnists in the newspapers. And it's all part of that effort to shape the media narrative to our advantage. And that's really what it's become in Washington. The permanent campaign, maybe long ago when it was initially started, focused on winning over public opinion, and then it kind of evolved, and now it's turned into this more unsavory side of things, where it's always focused on just manipulating public opinion, or manipulating these sources of public opinion, which you just described, to your advantage.
With talking points about your book, the word puzzled kept showing up in what everybody said.
That's right.
And I think it was on Jon Stewart's show, on The Daily Show, that they showed just a collage of everybody saying, oh, we're puzzled. This is puzzling. We're puzzled. And Stewart and also Olbermann, Keith Olbermann on MSNBC, do this all the time now. They take the talking points and they show like a half dozen people saying exactly the same thing, making it really clear this is an official talking point. What's the reaction in the White House to shows like Jon Stewart's and Keith Olbermann's and Stephen Colbert's, where there's news and comedy mixed together in a way that is kind of new on television? Does that have an impact in the White House, and is it affecting how they deal with their talking points?
Oh, the White House fully recognizes the influence that those programs have. I mean, in terms of, you know, it's a little different for some of the ones that you mentioned. Keith Olbermann, I know that the White House does not have much regard for that program. But I have found it since I've left the White House to be an entertaining way to kind of get to some of the important issues and discuss some of the important truths behind those issues. But, yeah, it's interesting the way, you know, I think that those The Daily Show, for instance, when you talk about the way they put it together and they show how coordinated the response is and how all the talking points are very similar, I think it does help educate viewers and people across the country about how these things work. And it's important to understand how it works so you can decipher it and understand things for yourself, understand what's spin, what's manipulation, and what's reality.
So what's the experience been like for you being on a book tour where you're speaking for yourself, not on behalf of the Bush administration? Of course, you still have some talking points. You want to make the points that are in the book, and obviously you want to promote the book, but still you're speaking for yourself. You're not being told what you're supposed to say, what you're not allowed to say. You're not representing an administration.
It's very liberating. That's what it is. It's finally a chance to express my own views and hopefully share my experiences about what happened and help people learn from that. I understand the importance of message discipline, and there are certain points I want to get out when I go on programs like yours about the book, what happened, and I want to make sure that hopefully that this book can help contribute in a positive way to changing things for the better.
There are made a lot of that people, point.
Yeah, there are plenty of people out there in the country that are just fed up with how dysfunctional Washington has become, and that's really the larger message at the heart of this book.
It would be great if we could just talk and not do talking points.
Sure.
My guest is Scott McClellan, and he was the White House press secretary from July of 2003 through April of 2006. As I'm sure you know by now, he's written a memoir about that experience called What Happened: Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. I'd like to play one or two of the more dramatic moments of your press conferences and talk about what was happening in your mind or behind the scenes at this time. And this was, I think, a particularly uncomfortable press briefing for you. You had been telling the press that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby assured you that they had nothing to do with leaking Valerie Plame Wilson's name and that she was a CIA operative. Then the story broke that Rove did talk about her with at least one reporter. The reporters at the press briefing were asking you about that, and you refused to comment, saying you couldn't comment on an ongoing investigation. And then the reporters were saying, well, why couldn't you comment on it now when you seemed free to comment on it earlier, when what you were saying was, no, they didn't know anything.
Right.
So here's David Gregory questioning you July 11th, 2005.
Scott, can I ask you this? Did Karl Rove commit a crime?
Again, David, this is a question relating to an ongoing investigation, and you have my response related to the investigation. And I don't think you should read anything into it other than we're going to continue not to comment on it while it's ongoing.
Do you stand by your statement from the fall of 2003 when you were asked specifically about Carl and Elliot Abrams and Scooter Libby, and you said, I've gone to each of those gentlemen, and they have told me they are not involved in this? Do you stand by that statement?
And if you will recall, I said that as part of helping the investigators move forward on the investigation, we're not going to get into commenting on it. That was something I stated back near that time as well.
Scott, this is ridiculous. The notion that you're going to stand before us after having commented with that level of detail and tell people watching this that somehow you decided not to talk, you've got a public record out there. Do you stand by your remarks from that podium or not?
And again, David, I'm well aware, like you, of what was previously said, and I will be glad to talk about it at the appropriate time. The appropriate time is when the investigation...
Why are you choosing when it's appropriate, when it's inappropriate?
If you'll let me finish.
No, you're not finishing. You're not saying anything. You stood at that podium and said that Karl Rove was not involved, and now we find out that he spoke about Joseph Wilson's wife. So don't you owe the American public a fuller explanation? Was he involved or was he not? Because contrary to what you told the American people, he did indeed talk about his wife, didn't he?
David, there will be a time to talk about this, but now is not the time to talk about it.
Do you think people will accept that, what you're saying today?
Again, I've responded to the question. Go ahead, Terry.
Okay, that was my guest Scott McClellan with David Gregory of NBC at a White House press briefing July 11th, 2005. Scott McClellan, so why couldn't you comment then?
Well, the short answer is that the White House counsel's office tied my hands, as they did anyone that was speaking publicly at the White House. They said, we're not going to talk about this. This is an ongoing legal proceeding, and you can't talk about it. I actually, back at that, shortly after that time, or even around that time, I told White House reporters that someday I looked forward to talking about this. And I think they came to realize that I was very sincere in that. That was an extremely difficult period because I could not defend what I had previously said about 2 years earlier. I did tell reporters 2 years prior to that that Scooter Libby and Karl Rove had both assured me that they were not involved in the leaking of Valerie Plame's identity. It's interesting how that came about. Part of that was conversations with Karl Rove. Karl Rove had also told the president he was not involved, and the president and I had a discussion about that. And then about a week later after the investigation broke, the president and vice president spoke and directed me to exonerate Scooter Libby, as well as in addition to Carl, because his name was coming up in some of the conversation and some of the Washington rumor mill. And I said, the only way I will do that, told the chief of staff, Andy Carr, the only way I will do that is if Scooter Libby gives me the same assurances that Karl Rove did. And so I got Scooter on the phone. He was traveling with the vice president then, and said asked him exactly what I asked Carl. Were you involved in this, the leaking of Valerie Plame's identity, in any way? And he said, no, absolutely not. Carl had given me the same assurances, unequivocal. No, we were not involved. And there's nothing more important for the press secretary than his credibility. And what the press secretary says has to be based on what he believes to be true. And it was back then. But then when it is found out that it's not true and you can't correct the record, that makes it extremely difficult to continue in that position. And over time, it would eventually be a chief reason why I left the White House. That really set in this period of disillusionment in me because I was, rightly as David did, battered for not being able to, or for going into this no comment mode. It's a terrible position to be in for, no comment is just a terrible communication strategy. You've got to be able to explain things and set the record straight when needed, particularly if something you said previously later turns out not to be the case.
Well, you know, Rove and Libby lied to you because they told you they had nothing to do with it. So you're on the podium saying no comment, no comment, no comment, when you're probably feeling really aggrieved at that moment, but you can't let that on to the press. So what did you say to Rove and Libby that day?
Well, it's interesting because one of the things that happened also in the investigation was, as it got underway, everybody in the White House stopped talking to each other because people were being called before the grand jury. They were hiring lawyers. I never hired a lawyer. That was just my personal choice. But so we couldn't talk to each other. And we were told by the White House counsel's office that we shouldn't be talking internally with one another about it. I think that we mishandled this in a number of ways. But Carl did later that day, that first day after the Gregory question that you played, called me and in a very generic way expressed that he was sorry for what I was going through. Then the next day, Andy Card was gone or out at the moment. So Carl, was, as deputy chief of staff, was running the senior staff meeting that morning. And the first thing he did, because I usually talk to the press secretary, I'd usually go second in the senior staff meeting, was turn and look at me and say, you know, basically, I'm sorry what you're going through, and in front of the whole senior staff. And I didn't say much in response. It had been the news coverage was pretty brutal, as it was expected to be. And I pretty much said, you know, thanks, and that's about it, in a very muted voice. And then the next day, after 3 days of going through it, I walked back to my office from, I think it was a policy briefing that the president had had, or maybe a world leader meeting that I was participating in, and I find a note in my chair. It's a handwritten note from Karl Rove, again, not specific, but expressing his apologies for what I was going through. And Karl was ably defended publicly by conservatives, the part of the ones that you talked about earlier in the interview that we call on for to help get our message out when we need to advocate something or defend the record one way or the other. But it was interesting that it wasn't long after that that the ones that came to my defense when I couldn't speak publicly for myself were actually the White House reporters. David Gregory went on the air and said Scott McClellan's got a sterling reputation. At the same time, though, he said, but he's not able to set the record straight. And, you know, that's a problem. That's a problem for him, and that's a problem for the public. The public deserves to have the answers.
My guest is Scott McClellan. His new memoir is called What Happened. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott McClellan, and he was the White House press secretary from July of 2003 through April of 2006. As I'm sure you know by now, he's written a memoir about that experience called What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. I want to play another White House press briefing clip, and this is from October 13th, 2005, and here it's Helen Thomas who is asking you the questions, and this is about the war in Iraq.
President Mita, what do you mean by total victory? That we will never leave Iraq until we have total victory. What does that mean?
Free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East, because a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East will be a major blow to the ambitions.
If they ask us to leave, then we'll leave.
Okay, I'm trying to respond. Well, a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the broader Middle East will be a major blow to the ambitions of al-Qaeda and their terrorist associates. They want to establish or impose their rule over the broader Middle East. We saw that in the Zawahiri letter that was released earlier this week by the intelligence community. Well, Helen, the president recognizes that we are engaged in a global war on terrorism. And when you're engaged in a war, it's not always pleasant, and it's certainly a last resort. But when you engage in a war, you take the fight to the enemy. You go on the offense, and that's exactly what we're doing. We are fighting them there so that we don't have to fight them here. September 11th taught us.
Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11.
Yeah, well, you have a very different view of the war on terrorism, and I'm sure you're opposed to the broader war on terrorism. The president recognizes this requires a comprehensive strategy, and that this is a broad war, that it is not a law enforcement matter.
Sorry, on what basis do you say Helen is opposed to the broader war on terrorism?
Well, she certainly expressed her concerns about Afghanistan and Iraq and going into those two countries. I think I can go back and pull up her comments over the course of the past couple of years.
And speak for her, which is odd.
I said she may be, because certainly if you look at her comments over the course of the past couple of years, she has expressed her concerns.
Okay, so that was Helen Thomas and my guest Scott McClellan at a press briefing. Scott McClellan, was it a tactic when you or anyone else in the White House was getting tough, challenging questions to try to discredit the reporter asking the questions, in Helen Thomas's case, to say, well, sure, you're saying that because you don't believe in the broader war on terrorism? Or like when David Gregory was asking you after Hurricane Katrina if you had confidence, if Bush had confidence in the head of FEMA and the head of Homeland Security, and you kept accusing him of playing the blame game, of finger-pointing, and he said, no, I want to know, it's a legitimate question, do you have confidence in the head of FEMA and Homeland Security? And you kept saying, no, you're playing the blame game. So was that like a conscious tactic when someone's asking a question that seems challenging or, you know, negative, to try to discredit them or make it seem like they were being unpatriotic? Can you talk about that?
Well, I don't know so much about, at least from my standpoint, about unpatriotic, but yes, in terms of deflecting the question or maybe discrediting. I mean, certainly in the instance when you played with Helen Thomas, she is now an opinion columnist, and she has very strong opinions, and she is also a very good reporter. But absolutely, I mean, sometimes you're trying to deflect the question and maybe turn it back to where you'll be in the position where you're on the offensive instead of in this defensive crouch. And other times, like with Helen Thomas, you're trying to turn it back to the broader message we were trying to get across at the time, which was that what I said in response to her about fighting them over there instead of fighting them over here and things of that nature.
You know, it's funny, you know, in the book you accuse the press of being too deferential to the White House, particularly in regard to the decision over going to war. But when they did challenge you, you would deflect questions and sometimes accuse them of being unfair in their questions. Is it that your opinion changed, or is it that that's how you saw your job at the time, to just kind of push back at challenging questions?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what I was saying there at the time I felt was sincere, but some of it now, reflecting upon it now and looking back as I wrote the book, some of it was badly misguided. I got caught up in this whole politics as war mentality and the permanent campaign culture, just like so many other people do. And I think they're very good people on both sides of the aisle, but so many people go to Washington to, you know, really they get involved in politics to make a positive difference like I did. But then they go to Washington, it all becomes this focus on power and influence instead of bipartisan deliberation and compromise. And you get caught up in playing the game the way it's played. And I certainly did, as much as anybody else.
Did anyone in the Bush administration ever suggest to you that you should punish members of the press who were too aggressive in their questioning? Or did you hear, as press secretary, about how the Bush administration, or if the Bush administration, wanted to punish members of the press who published leaks or wrote investigative stories that were negative about the Bush administration?
Well, there's some of that, certainly some of that mentality in the White House. I think it's counterproductive. Now, there were times, though, when someone would say, even at times when the president would say, about such and such article, did you let them know? And I would go direct to that reporter, and I'd say that, you know, some of this was noticed at the White House and wasn't well received and thought it was off base, and here's why. Sometimes when the president would do that, it was because Mrs. Bush had read an article. She certainly read things a lot more closely than he did at times in the press coverage. But I personally don't recall any time when I went and said, we're going to freeze you out or anything like that. Was there a little bit of that? Yeah, there probably was a little bit of that. It may have happened at different levels, necessarily from the press secretary.
Scott McClellan will be back in the second half of the show. His memoir is called What Happened: Inside the Bush Administration and Washington's Culture of Deception. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Out of the Blue, A History of Lightning, Science, Superstition, and Amazing Stories of Survival by John S. Friedman. From Concord Records, featuring the John Williams soundtrack CD to Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, available at Barnes & Noble. And from Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan talks about how President Bush misled the American people about why he was taking us to war in Iraq. And Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by the young country music singer Ashton Shepard, who he says has a voice that's deep and knowing. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Scott McClellan. McClellan has written the kind of book he had to criticize when he was press secretary, an inside account of what he describes as the culture of deception in the Bush administration. McClellan served as President Bush's press secretary from July 2003 through May 2006. During President Bush's first term, McClellan was the chief deputy to Press Secretary Ari Fleischer. He started working for Bush in Texas as a gubernatorial spokesperson. Let's talk about Iraq. You write a lot about the lead-up to a war in Iraq and what came afterwards in your book. One of the things you write is that Bush and then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld decided to update the Pentagon's war plans for Iraq in November 2001. In effect, you say, Bush had already made the decision to go to war, even if he convinced himself it might still be avoided. You say war was inevitable, given the course of action the president set from the beginning. Bush managed the crisis in a way that almost guaranteed that the use of force would become the only feasible option. Are you saying that this was intentional, to make sure that there was no other option, that Bush did things like give an ultimatum at the UN, order a massive buildup of American arms and military forces in the region, to make sure that no matter what Congress wanted, no matter what the UN said, there was no choice but to go to war?
Well, he left himself no flexibility whatsoever, and I think his advisors served him poorly in that way. The president should always maintain some flexibility, but it goes to what you just brought up, that the president really had, I would come to learn, made his decision, and it's the way President Bush operates or approaches policy. He tends to be an instinctive player and make the policy decision early on and then say, how do we go about implementing this? And the policy decision he made early on was that we're going to confront Saddam Hussein, and not too long after 9/11, we're going to confront Saddam Hussein. We're going to remove his regime unless he comes fully clean. And I don't think, reflecting back on this, I think it was probably unreasonable to expect that Saddam Hussein was going to be the kind of guy, given his past, that would just come fully clean and say, okay, come into my country and you can go all over it and do whatever you want.
You described the president as being an instinctive leader. And in the book, you describe him as having a headstrong style of leadership. But I think so many people have wondered how much of the decision-making in the White House, particularly the decision to go to war, came from President Bush versus from Vice President Cheney or from Donald Rumsfeld, from Paul Wolfowitz, from neoconservatives in and outside government. Being a former insider yourself, do you have a sense of how much of that policy was really initiated by President Bush and how much if it was him signing off on other people's decisions?
Well, yes, a number of those people you mentioned had these plans in place well before even joining the administration. And then they came into the administration, were put in positions of prominence, and had Iraq on their radar screen from the very beginning. And I think 9/11 provided some of those individuals an excuse or an opportunity, in their view, to carry out some of their plans. And that certainly influenced the president. They weren't the decision maker. The president was the ultimate decision maker, but they played into some of his thinking. And I think that the National Security Advisor has a very important role to play there when that is happening, and that is to make sure that other options are being explored, that he or she is challenging the president's thinking on this, his instincts, and making sure he understands the full consequences and cost of what he has taken the country into. And I don't think that Condi Rice, instead of doing that, I think my view is that she was more accommodating of the president's instincts than challenging those instincts, and probably should have been stood up more firmly to some of these strong personalities like the vice president, like Paul Wolfowitz, the deputy secretary of defense, like Secretary Rumsfeld, and she didn't.
You write that you finally figured out that the decision to go to war was based largely on the desire within the Bush administration to overthrow Saddam Hussein and then spread democracy through the Middle East. The dream of a democratic Middle East, you say, was the most powerful force behind Bush's drive to war. But, you say, Bush and his advisors knew that the American people would most certainly not support a war launched primarily for the ambitious purpose of transforming the Middle East. And then you say that rather than open this Pandora's box about spreading democracy through the Middle East, because that would raise all kinds of questions,
right,
that instead the Bush administration tried to make the WMD threat larger than it was. They tried to make the Iraqi connection to terrorism appear more certain than it was. They quietly ignored or disregarded some of the crucial caveats in the intelligence, minimized evidence that pointed in the opposite direction. They used innuendo and implication to encourage Americans to believe things that were unclear or possibly false about Iraq. A lot of people have said this, but you're saying it from having been within the inner circle. Tell us something that led you to these conclusions that only somebody within the inner circle would know about.
Well, when I became press secretary, I participated in many world leader meetings with the president and saw up close in these small group settings how passionately the president believed in the freedom agenda, believed in transforming the Middle East as a key component of the war on terrorism. And over the course of time, I came to learn that that was really what was driving his decision-making on Iraq and his belief. And it's also something that probably clouds some of his judgment today in terms of being able to recognize some of the larger realities of the problems that we have faced over the course of time being in there. But one of the themes in the book that I talk about is how dangerous it can become when you take this permanent campaign, this political campaign mentality, and transfer that over to the war-making decision process or war-making campaign process. When you engage too much in trying to sell the war and you get caught up in doing what you would do for any political campaign or any other domestic policy issue, and start overstating or overpackaging the case, then it becomes very dangerous later on. And we saw that because we weren't as open and forthright as we should have been. And then it turned out that a lot of what we were saying was wrong.
If President Bush manipulated the facts to leave us to war, is that an impeachable offense?
Well, I don't take that view. It's not that anyone went, and I don't think there's no evidence to show that anyone said change the intelligence. Most of the focus in recent years has been on the faulty intelligence, and the White House has effectively deflected attention away from how the case was made to take the country to war. And the case, as I believe, was certainly overstated and oversold, but it could be substantiated. The biological and chemical weapons side of things, I mean, most people believe that Saddam Hussein had some biological and chemical weapons. But when you take the nuclear intelligence, which had lesser confidence than the bio and chem intelligence, and then take the terrorist connection, which had even lower confidence from the intelligence community, and package all that together and make it sound more certain and more grave and more urgent than it is, then you run into the problems that this administration has run into now, and you lose a lot of credibility. But I don't know of any evidence that when I think of something impeachable, I'm thinking of something where they said, you know, you change this intelligence or pressured analysts to change the intelligence. And I have no knowledge of any of that, nor do I believe that that happened.
Were there ever times, particularly after you realized, well, the real goal of this war was to try to spread democracy in the Middle East, and they exaggerated intelligence and downplayed other intelligence in order to start the war in Iraq? Did you at any point, after having this realization, think, Mr. President, I don't want to have to say this. Mr. President, I don't want to have to defend this anymore in the press conferences?
Well, I can't say. I mean, again, when in the buildup to the war, I was, like many Americans, willing to defer to the judgment of the president and his advisors. We were caught up.
I understand that, but after the war, I mean, you were the war's still going on.
right. Well, it was
still
a long time.
You still had to deal with it. Yeah.
Right. It was a long time coming and understanding and accepting the fact that, well, there's no weapons of mass destruction to be found. The rationale that we sold the war to the American people on was wrong. It took a long time to come to grips with that, and a lot of the coming to grips was going back and over the better part of a year, really reflecting on this and looking back on it and understanding it. Because when you're there in the White House, I mean, I still have a great personal affection for the president, but you're caught up in it all, and it's hard to see the larger perspective on things. I mean, you're in there 18 hours a day, working day in and day out, traveling all over the country and world as well, and you think that this is the way things are done. And I've come to the realization that the way things are done needs to change. It's not the way that I would have preferred to do things, but I very much was caught up in it just like everybody else.
You write about President Bush that he was insulated from the reality of events on the ground and consequently began falling into the trap of believing his own spin. When you say he was insulated from the reality of events on the ground, it makes me wonder, and a lot of people have speculated about this, does he really read the newspapers? Does he really follow what's going on in the world? Or is he perhaps intentionally kept insulated from that, so that people who are, for instance, driving some of the policy on the war in Iraq, that they won't be questioned or challenged by the president?
Right. No, I understand. He does skim through the newspapers and certainly look at some of the big stories. He resists reading opinion pieces or editorials. In his view, he says, I already know what they're going to say. Why do I need to read that? I think it would probably be better, and it's good for any president, to see a wide range of views and even read those and understand them. You might just learn something that you didn't think about, or if you can step back and realize, don't take this personally, but set aside what might be certain political perspective or partisan viewpoint in some of those and see if there's anything you can learn from what is being said, the main points that are being made there.
Do you think he intentionally insulated himself from information that might contradict him or that other people within the administration were just as happy that he not be aware of information that contradicted his position?
There might have been some, and I certainly think that he was not exposed to as wide of views as he should have been. I mean, I think one of the things that needs to happen is to make sure that you have plenty of independent experts on the outside that are constantly coming and visiting with the president. And there were some to an extent, but it was not a very diverse group of people. I mean, I don't think that he had people like Brent Scowcroft, his father's national security advisor, who warned against going into Iraq, saying it was unnecessary back in August of 2002, coming in on a regular basis to meet with the president. I never saw that. You had Henry Kissinger, but it would have been good to expose the president to some, even Carter's former national security advisor, Brzezinski, who is a big critic of the administration. Well, why not put him together with some others that have different views as well and bring them into the White House and form so the president can be better informed about some of these things. But the president is the type of person that his view is that he doesn't want to sit there and waste his time with someone who's, just going to sit there and be critical to some extent. That mentality plays into his mindset.
My guest is Scott McClellan. His new memoir is called What Happened. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott McClellan. He was the White House press secretary from July 03 to May of 06, and his new memoir about those years is called What Happened. I've got a John Hagee question for you. You devote some of your memoir, What Happened, to social conservatives and their influence on policy in the Bush administration. And I know when John Hagee, who's been so much in the news lately, ever since his endorsement of McCain, which that's a bond that's been broken.
Yes.
When he had his first summit for the Christian Zionist group that he founded, Christians United for Israel, President Bush sent a recorded greeting to Hagee and to the conference. Did Hagee have much sway within the Bush administration?
Well, he was one of a number of evangelical pastors on the social conservative ones that were certainly part of our outreach at the White House. We had a person in public liaison that was specifically tasked with reaching out to social conservative leaders. And so those leaders, yes, had a heavy influence on some of the White House policies. And I think that was one of the things that also hurt the president, was that at times it looked like his emphasis was on some of these issues that were important to social conservatives, like Terri Schiavo, like the constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage and stem cell research. I think a lot of people are wondering, why are you spending so much time focusing on these issues when, you know, there are issues on energy and healthcare and the economy that need to be addressed?
So Pastor Hagee was influential within the Bush administration.
I'd say he was one of a number that certainly had had some influence and was able to quickly get someone on the phone at the White House. So, yes.
So were there times when you were press secretary when you thought, I am not being honest with myself or with the American people?
Well, I certainly wasn't on the leak episode, although that was unknowingly, and I only learned that later. I think that at the time I felt like I was being sincere in what I was saying. Again, some of it was badly misguided now upon reflection when I've looked back, but that was because I was playing the Washington game the way it's played. And now I was not, at times I was not comfortable in some of the pushback tactics that we used from a communication standpoint. And that's what I, you know, probably helped me really to go back and do some careful research and careful reflection to try to understand how Washington has gotten to this point today and why we exacerbated it and how we might be able to move beyond it.
Did the president cause problems for you just as a public speaker? And I'm thinking, for instance, of a classic moment when he was asked by John Dickerson, who was a Time White House correspondent, about the president's biggest mistake after 9/11 and the lesson he learned from it. And as you say in the book, the president's answer was rambling, rather incoherent, and ultimately unsatisfying. And he basically said, well, he couldn't think of any mistakes he'd made. Maybe he'd think of it sometime in the future. And it would be helpful if he knew about this question in advance, but he wasn't told. So, I mean, that rambling, rather incoherent, ultimately unsatisfying description could fit a lot of the president's answers in public speaking. Was it difficult for you to hear him sometimes kind of speak incoherently? And did you ever give him feedback on that?
Yes, and I gave him brief feedback after the Dickerson question that you brought up. It was a painful one to sit through, and even though it was pauses of seconds, it seemed like an eternity at the time, and you're sitting there off to the side in your chair going, come on, you can answer this. But that was part of the problem. It was such a straightforward and direct question about mistakes you'd made, and this president is not one to reflect a whole lot while he's in office. Someday maybe he will more so on this, but also not one to be willing to acknowledge a mistake. And part of that's the environment in Washington, because as soon as you admit a mistake, you recognize people are going to jump all over it. But that is a very telling moment, and those are very telling moments, other ones similar to that, that show that, yes, this president, too, was very much one who tried to stay on message. And if you asked him that pointed question, very direct, open, and sometimes open-ended question, like, can you think of any mistake you've made since 9/11, or in the post-9/11 environment, and he can't answer it, it shows something very telling.
Earlier in the Bush administration, when insiders started leaving the administration and writing books about the problems they had with the administration, like Paul O'Neill's book, Richard Clark's book, and you were press secretary when Richard Clark's book was published, did you read those books, and did they place any doubts in your mind about what was going on in the administration?
I did not read those books, and part of it was just from my position, and at the time I thought, you know, we're not going to get into responding to these, so I won't read them right now. And I look forward to reading them now, though. And I have no reason to question the motives for writing those books now. Looking back, and I actually ran into Dick Clark the other day.
I know. I heard about that.
And apologized to him. But that's one of the points is that you know, yes, against Dick Clark, I was out there using our talking points and questioning some of it when I hadn't even read the book. So how could I be subscribing motivations to it?
But that's the point. Did you intentionally not read the book so, A, it wouldn't raise doubts in your mind about Bush administration policy and tactics, and B, so that you could say at the podium, I haven't read the book?
Well, it was more so the latter. I think to a much lesser extent the former, of being able to go out there and say, look, I'm not going to do a complete book review. We just don't engage in that. You know, by not reading it, I could say credibly that I haven't seen specifically what he said or read specifically what he said there.
So you had to protect yourself against reading it.
Yeah, I guess that's one way you could look at it, yes.
Good thing or a bad thing to do that?
Looking back, I would do it differently. I think I would try to read those books at the time. And you know, I was, when I took over as press secretary, I was 35 years young. I'd not spent a lifetime in Washington. There's a lot I've learned, and there are things that I would do differently, including speaking up more about some of those concerns internally. But this was at the same time, this is a White House that once the policy was set in place, the president expected everybody to kind of march in lockstep, did not welcome someone challenging or speaking up internally once the policy was put in place.
Scott McClellan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Scott McClellan served as President Bush's press secretary from July 2003 to May 2006. His new memoir is called What Happened. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker introduces us to a new country singer he likes. This is Fresh Air. Ashton Shepard had the Nashville equivalent of a Lana Turner Hollywood discovery story. Her mother drove her to the heart of the country music industry, and she showed up, unannounced, at the office of Jerry Kennedy, a legendary Nashville producer who's worked with singers like Tammy Wynette and Jerry Lee Lewis. Kennedy helped her get a record contract, and the result is her debut album, Sound So Good. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I've got a cold beer.
Twenty-one years old from Alabama, Ashton Shepard has the voice of a blousy 40-something on most of her album, Sound So Good, and I mean that as a compliment. Singing songs she wrote about ditching a stale marriage, shaking off a suffocating domestic existence, and getting drunk to blur the sight of an old love in a bar, Shepard follows in the tradition of country women from Wanda Jackson to Tanya Tucker to Dolly Parton. She knows in her bones what the future can hold for a woman who doesn't stand up for herself.
I'm not trying to start anything by coming up to you tonight. I know that it's yours now. It's sinking in with time. But tonight I've had too much to drink and it stays on my mind. I just wanted to say he's the best thing you'll ever find. 'Cause he ain't your regular Joe, you know. And I'm the crazy fool to let him go. And if he says he loves you, then that's what he means. He's the best man I've ever seen. I just wanted you to know he ain't your regular Joe.
Far from being a fight for your right to party affirmation album, Sound So Good is a big, ripe commercial recording for the commercial country industry of, about 1983. That is, when fiddles and a banjo and subject matter about working-class life were still viable hit single ingredients. Not for nothing does Shepard name-check Keith Whitley, a 1980s king of casualty, on one song here. Now, don't get me wrong, I really like the adolescent singer-songwriter lamentations of country music's current it girl, Taylor Swift. But Ashton Shepard's details in a song like I Ain't Dead Yet, with its careful scene setting about how even a life with a good husband and a child can leave a woman yearning for a cold one, well, you let Shepard sing that as the fiddles swell up around her, and you've got something like a classic.
I got a baby at home, a tiny less a mile long, and a husband who comes home each night. I do the laundry, I cook and clean, it's my responsibility, and I'm usually in the bed by
It's been reported that when he first heard her sing, Grand Ole Opry host and songwriting pro Bill Anderson said, quote, "This girl's so country she makes Loretta Lynn sound like she's from Liverpool." Me, I haven't heard any country singer since George Jones sing as lustily and heartbrokenly about drinking too much, and I haven't heard any woman as young as this with a voice as deep and knowing as Shepard's. Think Patsy Cline just hitting legal age. I realize these are extravagant comparisons, and who knows, maybe she'll never match the force of this major label debut. It's happened before. But right now, Shepard's got the most consistent, go-for-broke, the-hell-with-you country album out there.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Sound So Good by Ashton Shepard. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by Bo Diddley. The rock pioneer has died at the age of 79.
Bo Diddley caught a nanny goat to make a pretty baby a Sunday coat. Bo Diddley caught a bell cat to make a pretty baby a Sunday hat.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jenna Fischer about what happens behind the scenes on the set of The Office. She plays Pam, the receptionist. And we'll hear about her very first screen role in a sex education film for patients just released from the mental health unit of a hospital. Fischer co-stars in the new film, The Promotion. Join us for the next Fresh Air.